Now that's decreasing as they decay as a people in general because of their evil or prideful thoughts, I guess you'd say. And now this king decides to call himself the Lord of the West. How dumb can you get? Cool. All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Indeed we are. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about you?
Doing well. Just got my first shot yesterday. Super exciting.
Oh, dude, I just watched Aaron Rodgers' Jeopardy episodes. They were pretty good. I'll give the guy credit. They were pretty good, and he's been the most excited host so far. So I'm actually kind of rooting for him to get it, I guess, because he knows his stuff, and he's, yeah.
Wait, Aaron Rodgers is on Jeopardy.
He's the host, the guest host.
Oh, okay, guest host.
Because they've been doing a bunch of guest hosts to try to find who, like, and he's actually serious about the job. That's really? The funny part.
Yeah, that's very funny. He thinks he can do.
Yeah, he thinks he can do both football and Jeopardy. And it's like, all right, well, you probably got like 5 years max left of football. Uh-huh. So I don't know.
Gotta start warming up to the Jeopardy career.
Or maybe, yeah, it'll just make him retire faster and then the Bears can win. Yeah. All right, what are we doing today?
We have the second part of the special started, I don't know when exactly it will be released, but started a week or two ago.
We did that like a month ago at this point.
True. Okay.
It's been a while since we recorded anything.
Second part of a special that you've already heard at this point.
Which is
the first part of The Fall of Numenor.
Yeah. All right. So where I think we had gotten to was we had the setup, as they'll say further later tonight, it was the noontide of bliss in Numenor. That's how you would, what you would call it.
And,
you know?
And a little recap from last time. Numenor is an island in the middle of the ocean. Maybe not middle. Two thirds of the way between Middle Earth, Beleriand, what we now know as Middle Earth, but in the time of the Silmarillion is kind of Beleriand. It's two thirds between there and Valinor in the west. Yep. And it's inhabited. It was formed out of the ocean and basically gifted to a particular group of men because of their valiance and commitment to fighting with the elves against Morgoth in the Great Battle, right?
Right. Yeah, these are the people that are related to, like, Beren, Húrin, Túrin, those kind of people. So, yeah.
And now they're on this island. Everything's great. They can see or just barely see Valinor on the horizon from their highest tower, basically. They're great sailors. They're doing great, but they learn very quickly they're not allowed to sail any further
towards
Valinor.
And then have we heard, I literally can't even remember, do we hear grumblings about, or is that going to come, is that where we're about to start?
We cut it off. Well, we cut off our episode, I think, right at the point where we were running into the first grumblings.
Okay, well, then we'll get into it now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's see. So they become the greatest mariners of all time, right? They literally sail everywhere except west of Valinor because they're not allowed to, right? Mm-hmm. And that means all the spots of Middle Earth that we know from Lord of the Rings, because now that map is starting to look like the Lord of the Rings map that you're familiar with. And then way further south, way further north, way, way, way further south, basically kind of if Numenor is kind of in the position of, I guess, Bermuda, but then super enlarged.
Okay.
They did the equivalent of sailing to Asia just to explore it.
And came but back. By going east only.
Right, correct. Right, right. So they went south around Africa. The world's flat, Clifford. That's very important. So I'm serious.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so they had to go around Africa to do it, basically. The kind of the equivalence. You can, what is that? The Atlas of Middle Earth, Karen Forstead. Forstead. Look her up. And then they got pictures in there. I'm sure you can find it if you just Google that. Google that, and then Google probably all of Arda, and you'll see how far they traveled. It's pretty ridiculous, pretty crazy. Pretty cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want to take that first quote that I lined up there, though?
Yeah. And the lords of Numenor set foot again upon the western shores in the dark years of men, and none yet dared to withstand them. For most of the men of that age that sat under the shadow were now grown weak and fearful. And coming among them, the Numenoreans taught them many things. Corn and wine they brought, and they instructed men in the sowing of seed and the grinding of grain, in the hewing of wood and the shaping of stone, and in the ordering of their life, such as it might be in the lands of swift death and little bliss. Then the men of Middle-earth were comforted, and here and there upon the western shores, the houseless woods drew back, and men shook off the yoke of the offspring of Morgoth, and unlearned their terror of the dark. And they revered the memory of the tall sea kings. And when they had departed, they called them gods, hoping for their return. For at that time, the Numenoreans dwelt never long in Middle-earth, nor made there as yet any habitation of their own. Eastward they must sail, but ever west their hearts returned.
All right, what do you think of all that?
Well, multiple things at once. One is like, okay, straightforward, they're expanding east and like slowly spreading their influence. On the other hand, it's kind of like this strange double melancholy thing because they're returning back to a land that their ancestors once knew, right? That has since become worse after they've left and has become like, you know, under the shadow of Morgoth. But they're also thinking themselves about the land that they came, that they were literally born in, which is the island out in the sea. And so they, it's like they're oscillating east and west. Of like return exploring new frontiers, which are the same as where more distantly they came from, and then wanting to go west, but coming up to a block. So I feel like you naturally see the tension between. It's almost like they're the geography is reinforcing the feeling that they're like only looking at their own past. I think, and they can't ever go forward beyond that. So you can imagine the frustration.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to state the obvious, when they say west, they mean west of Numenor, which means Valinor. Like, they really want to go check that out. They've checked out everything else. Oh, it's the one part that we're not allowed to check out, and we really want to check out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And so with that, I'll start introducing here. Let's start the drama, the conflict of this whole story. Here we go. Now this yearning grew ever greater with the years, and the Numenoreans began to hunger for the undying city that they saw from afar, and the desire of everlasting life, to escape from death and the ending of delight, grew strong upon them. And ever as their power and glory grew greater, their unquiet increased. For though the Valar had rewarded the Dunedain with long life, they could not take away from them the weariness of the world that comes at last. And they died, even their kings of the seed of Arendil, and the span of their lives was brief in the eyes of the Eldar. Thus it was that a shadow fell upon them, in which maybe the will of Morgoth was at work, that still moved in the world. And the Numenoreans began to murmur, at first in their hearts, and then in open words, against the doom of men, and most of all, against the ban which forbade them to sail into the west. Thoughts on that?
Or it's pretty big. Am I supposed to, should we keep, finish that one out, or are we doing the quote, the second half after? Okay, yeah, we can discuss the first chunk.
Oh, no, well, actually, let's just, read that part.
Okay.
Read the next part, too.
And they said among themselves, why do the lords of the west sit there in peace unending, while we must die and go we know not whither, leaving our home and all that we have made? And the elder die not, even those that rebelled against the lords. And since we have mastered all seas, and no water is so wild or so wide that our ships cannot overcome it, why should we not go to Avalon and greet there our friends? And some there were who said, why should we not go even to Aman and taste there, were it but for a day, the bliss of the powers? Have we not become mighty among the people of Arda?
Okay. So what do we think of all that? That's pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, I've obviously we've talked about like strong Christian and Catholic references before in Tolkien's work, but without even needing any like background in like the kind of like biblical corruption or something, it just I feel like it comes through so strong. Like,
yeah,
it's been broken. They're suddenly thirsting for something that they for this power that they think will like save them or yeah, it's immediately you just feel it that it's they've gone astray, you know.
Yeah, this is like Tower of Babel
right.
kind of stuff where they're I don't know, they think in their pride that they can accomplish something that oh come on, we you know, we've all heard stories like this. We know this is not a good idea. Yeah. This isn't gonna have a good end if they keep going this way, right?
But it's like it's that type of thing where it's like they're what was the word you just used?
Prideful.
Yeah, yeah. It's like their pride is combining with their thirst for power, is combining with their I mean, maybe it's just those two things. It's like everything sort of overlays and compounds. Like one, no one piece is like totally destroying them or leading to this. But it's like immediately you see once they start to think they're a little better than everyone around them, they're like, why are we stuck here? Why are we stuck back here with the losers? And then they see themselves as equals with these great people that they know, that like the elves. Yeah. And so they have immediately begun to understand the world as inherently set against them.
Yeah.
So it's, and yeah, anyways, very interesting.
Right.
This sets it up for basically the rest of the story.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is the theme of the rest of this episode as we'll keep going here. So yeah. So Manwë hears rumors of this and he's super grieved and yeah, he's pretty upset. So anyways, he sends messengers to them from Valinor, and I would assume they're elves. But he says to them, we can't take away your fate. If you came here to Numenor, it wouldn't make... Or sorry, if you came here to Valinor, it wouldn't make you deathless. This place is the Undying Lands because everyone here is deathless. If you came here, to quote the messengers, you would but wither and grow weary the sooner, as moths in a light too strong and steadfast. That's a token detail if I've ever heard one. that's a good comparison. But him and Lewis are really good about the similes or the the metaphors.
Definitely. But that one also is like you can just imagine the Numenoreans hearing that. They're like, nope, I want to see that bright light. Like, I am really curious about that light.
Or you're comparing me to a moth?
How yeah, exactly. You? Like, you think I can't handle like truth and power?
Yeah, yeah. So the Numenoreans debate with these messengers a bit, and then the best line of it, reinforcing Finrod's position from that Finrod and Andreth conversation. You remember that? We should have said that before. That should be fresh in our minds for this whole episode. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go check it out. It is fresh in my mind because I'm literally editing it now.
Nice.
So it's actually coming out pretty good in my opinion. So cool. Yeah. But anyways, let's see. What's the one line from the? I think this is the messengers. The Eldar, you say, are unpunished, and even those who rebel do not die. Yet that is to them neither reward nor punishment, but the fulfillment of their being. They cannot escape and are bound to this world, never to leave it as long as it lasts, for its life is theirs. And then the messengers go on to say about men. Thus you escape and leave the world and are not bounded to it, and hope or in weariness. Which of us, therefore, should envy the others?
Why should not we envy the Valar, or even the least the deathless? The Numenoreans, this is the Numenoreans responding to the messenger. For of us is required a blind trust, and a hope without assurance, knowing not what lies before us in a little while. And yet we also love the earth and would not lose it.
And then the messengers come back and they say, indeed, the mind of Iluvatar concerning you is not known to the Valar, and he has not revealed all things that are to come. But this we hold to be true, that your home is not here, neither in the land of Aman, nor anywhere within the circles of the world. And the doom of men, that they should depart, was at first a gift of Iluvatar. It became a grief to them only because, coming under the shadow of Morgoth, it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness, of which they were afraid. And some grew willful and proud and would not yield, until life was reft from them. We who bear the ever-mounting burden of the years do not clearly understand this. But if that grief has returned to trouble you, as you say, then we fear that the shadow arises once more and grows again in your hearts. Therefore, though you be the Dunedain, fairest of men, who escaped from the shadow of old and fought valiantly against it, we say to you, beware. The will of Eru will not be gainsaid, and the Valar bid you earnestly not to withhold the trust to which you are called, lest soon it become again a bond by which you are constrained. Hope rather that in the end, even the least of your desires shall have fruit. The love of Arda was set in your hearts by Iluvatar, and he does not plant to no purpose. Nonetheless, many ages of men unborn may pass ere the purpose is made known, and to you it will be revealed, and not to the Valar. All right, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Let's break that down a bit.
it's a lot. I thought of these reading through it like they're, I mean, they're really tit for tat arguing. Messengers like,
yeah,
you can't come. And the men are like, yeah, we could. We would be able to get there. Like, we could do it. And messengers like, no, even if you did, it wouldn't do anything. The messengers like, oh, but it must. Like, we're still curious. And it's point by point. And then this is the messenger's closing statement, basically. But there's so much in here. It's like, I'm sure I'm going to skip something. We've got the messenger responding or addressing like the broader mortality of men, much in the way we talked about during the Finrod and Andrith conversation.
Yeah, but then I really like the part where but we hold this to be true, that your home is not here, neither is the land of Aman nor anywhere within the circles of the world. Because I mean, that was point for point from the Finrod and Andrith conversation. Like, that was, we spent a good chunk of time on that. So that should be familiar to anybody that's listened to that episode recently, I guess. But, yeah. I mean, what'd you like though?
Yeah, that's very cool. But then this, I just like the, how much is covered here. It's like this bit at the end, as I see it, after discussing the mortality of men, as you were mentioning, then the messengers are speaking to like the history of the world and the future of the world, kind of like almost a glimpse to all of this stuff beyond. And then it's just like a casual warning, like, and if you totally want to ignore us, don't even think about us, but remember that you're still going to be put in your place, and we can't control you. We don't even have the power to grant you what you're looking for. But it's kind of, yeah, it's like very foreboding warning at the end that I like.
Yeah.
To basically saying, like, ultimately, we can't stop you from doing this, but it's your own doom that you're asking for, basically.
Yeah, it will. And then they're also coming to him, too. Like, we recognize you guys were the best of men. You guys were the guys that helped us. But come on. Be careful here, because you've seen other evil, wicked men. Don't become evil and wicked yourselves. They're clearly warning about it. And so now we got to see how they respond.
Mm-hmm.
Which, at this point, leadership starts to decay even more. And to quote it, it says, "The Numenor was in the zenith of its bliss, if not yet its power." So at this point, apparently, when they go to Middle Earth, they're extracting tribute from men instead of giving away gifts now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, okay, that's another crappy sign. So now we're starting to form a
like a predatorial colonial empire type thing.
Right,
like,
yeah. I think you would say the colonial empire in the...
this is like
not good sense,
right?
The really not the not give and take, the one-sided
yeah. empire kind of. Yeah. yeah, which you could make more modern or ancient analogies, I'm sure. But this is the part where I'm immediately my head jumps to descriptions of Rome, where it gets to the point that its economy can only be sustained by just like more wars, capturing more people, and pulling value out of.
If Rome actually got there. Rome got to a point where they closed the border and then they just worked on holding off Germans from invading for centuries.
That was later, though. I don't know my Roman history as well as you, but from what I've read, there's like a stretch where it looked like they were doing okay. Like they were technically winning wars and expanding, but there wasn't any basically any economic generation inside the empire. So it was just like they had to continue gaining territory to keep generating enough wealth to keep the primary empire afloat.
Potentially.
Point being,
I think lots of their stuff was just conquered by ambitious people trying to make a name, which isn't good, but it's also just, wow, let's talk about larger than life personalities. But that's getting off topic.
Yeah. Anyways, you can kind of sub in any colonial empire you would imagine, yeah. But that's.
Or the Star Wars empire.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. So now they get to this point where the current king who heard those messengers, he was probably the one debating with him, potentially, or maybe he had advisors do it because he's too good, right? Anyways, him and a healthy percentage of the people, they dislike the messenger's answer, and they want to escape death within their lifetime, obviously. So, you know, but that's a big challenge. All right, so apparently before this, when men got to an old age, or good men got to an old age, and they knew their time was come, their life was fully lived, they could put their affairs in order and then just kind of relinquish life, as in kind of die in your sleep, almost, you know. And I wouldn't call that suicide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, it's just peaceful. Yeah. There's not a fear of death.
And it's specifically, you know, your time's there. So yeah, now here you can voluntarily do it peacefully.
Right.
That is until this king, who lived to a great age, clinging to his life beyond the end of all joy. And he was the first of the Numenoreans to do this, refusing to depart until he was witless and unmanned, and denying his son the kingship at the height of his days. All right, so we got somebody that's just, yeah, clearly afraid of death, and so lives as long as he can, and then his last days are just awful, horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of. Maybe you do have a personal experience of like a relative or something with that, but I mean, that's something that is common enough that everybody's heard or seen. Yeah. All right. Next king comes to power. Numenor divides into two factions. There's the Kingsmen who hate the elves and the Valar, and they want to figure out how to attain immortality. And then the other faction, the good one, is the elf friends, who they're going to start calling the faithful, but Tolkien didn't actually make that clear, so I don't know. It was an easy jump to make later, but they start being referred to as the faithful. And those are the ones that stayed loyal to the king, but also wish to be friends with the elves, and then also listen to the Valar's council. So those two things, they kind of come to a head, though.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do both?
Right.
Hopefully, I guess you just got to get a good king or something.
Right.
But yeah.
Or you're forced into treason.
Yeah. So at this point, the zenith of bliss is over, but life still went on in Numenor. You want to take that paragraph?
But the fear of death grew ever darker upon them, and they delayed it by all means that they could, and they began to build great houses for their dead, while their wise men labored unceasingly to discover, if they might, the secret of recalling life, or at the least, the prolonging of men's days. Yet they achieved only the art of preserving incorrupt the dead flesh of men, and they filled all the land with silent tombs, in which the thought of death was enshrined in darkness. But those that lived turned the more eagerly to pleasure and revelry, desiring ever more goods and riches, and after the days of Tar and Caliman, the offering of the first fruits to Eru was neglected, and men went seldom any more to the hollow upon the heights of Meneltharma in the midst of the land.
All right, so we got some alchemy going, trying to find elixir of life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, sorcerer stone stuff. The those that live turned to pleasure and revelry, that reminded me of the Romans and everlasting man, mm-hmm, you know, who start mm-hmm. living without a purpose when the mythology's running on fumes.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked all about that at this point. And then abandoning worship of Eru Iluvatar, clear sign of decay and dysfunction, mm-hmm. and just generally, come on, this isn't going to be good.
Yeah.
This is going to lead to something, yeah, productive or anything.
And then
you got any other thoughts?
The detail about, like, their obsession with death is super interesting, because it doesn't, like, necessarily sound bad at face value, like, if this was described in a different way in a different paragraph. But it's clearly being associated here with, like, placing it above life in the wrong way.
Right.
And then the detail about preserving incorrupt flesh. Now they seem more like Egyptian than Roman to me in that little bit. But yeah, all the references are pulling from Mediterranean culture in some way, it feels like. Stronger Egyptian vibes starting out now, which I find actually continue to pick up.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool. All right, so then at this point, they're starting to go back to Middle-earth and make permanent settlements. For their own land seemed to them shrunken, and they had no rest or content therein, and they desired now wealth and dominion in Middle-earth, since the West was denied. So they're going to settle for Middle-earth and just rule that, because they can. And Numenor now doesn't seem like this perfect, blissful place. It seems small, tiny. We got to expand. We got to find more to life almost, right?
Mm-hmm. You
know, that's what I was picking up, at least.
Definitely.
So they make great harbors and towers, but they appeared now rather as lords and masters and gatherers of tribute than as helpers and teachers. And then that's all the Kingsmen stuff. There are still the elf friends, and when they go to Middle-earth, they actually aid Gil-galad, and they fight the elves and fight Sauron. Now, the Kingsmen aren't friendly with Sauron, but still, the elf friends are obviously, by definition, still friends with the elves, right? Mm-hmm. You know? And their haven was Pelagiar, above the mouths of Anduin the Great. But the Kingsmen sailed far away south. All right, so Pelagiar is at the mouths of the Anduin, so we're talking Middle-earth lands, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anduin, we know that river.
Mm-hmm.
So this tower's in Gondor proper.
Okay.
Or what will become Gondor proper. So all the elf friends are hanging out with the elves in the northwest of Middle Earth. All the other ones, the bad guys of Numenor, they're going further south.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, which is that kind of like the hot desert area, I guess.
Okay.
I don't quite know why they would pick that, but that's what they're doing. So, yeah. That's like Harad and all the desert peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so then, so I mentioned Sauron, did I?
You did.
Where?
Just in that the elf friends were helping in the fight against Sauron.
Oh, where did I actually say that, though?
In your, right at the bottom of the page, right before you talked about Pelargir.
Oh. Oh, okay. All right, cool. Oh, yeah, I did mention it. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm like slow today. I don't know why. Nice. Okay. So Sauron was mentioned. Okay. So what you got to remember is he had those initial, we talked about this in the Galadriel special. So he had those initial wars when he created the One Ring of Power and he killed Celebrimbor. You know, he was the elf that made the three rings and he made those in Eregion, which was right outside of Moria,
mm-hmm.
the Mines of Moria.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sauron went all the way up there and he had everybody kind of boxed in either in the Grey Havens area or Rivendell. And then they were about to get overrun at the Grey Havens, I believe. But then that's when the Numenorean ships all came in. And then they beat them back. And then every single river outlet down, they kept ambushing Sauron again. So he had to keep retreating and retreating. And he was losing chunk after chunk of his army until he got back to Mordor with just basically kind of his bodyguard, you know, his personal company, you know, and I mean that was it. So he hates Numenoreans. He already knows who they're all descended from beforehand, so he hates them anyways because he hates Beren and Lúthien, anybody that's descended from them, you know. So these people, not friends with them. But by this point in the Second Age, You want to take that?
Sauron learned that the kings of Numenor had increased in power and splendor, and he hated them the more, and he feared them, lest they should invade his lands and wrest from him the dominion of the East. But for a long time he did not challenge the lords of the sea, and he withdrew from the coasts. Yet Sauron was ever guileful, and it is said that among those whom he ensnared with the nine rings, three were lords of Numenorean race. And when the Ulairi arose, that were the ringwraiths, his servants, and the strength of his terror and mastery over men had grown exceedingly great, he began to assail the strong places of the Numenoreans upon the shores of the sea.
So that's pretty big.
Yeah. So he, first of all, a testament to how strong they are is that he actually, he fears going into battle with them head to head. They're too powerful.
Yeah.
Which means,
yeah,
by kind of reasoning everything, they're seem like the most powerful army in the world right now. Maybe you could say if they are actually pitted against the elves are stronger, but they're clearly a very dangerous force.
Yeah. Well, dude, what about the three rings there?
Yeah.
Three of the nine. That's crazy.
I know.
Also, though, so that is what they're saying. Three of the nine men that take the rings are Numenoreans. That's nuts.
Right.
How dumb could they be to take a ring from Sauron?
No kidding. I was going to say, does it seem like that just means he has spies now? Like he's infiltrated their ranks in a big way? Or they're like full on the ring race that we know from Lord of the Rings, and it just happens that changes his balance of power?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know exactly how this starts. They could have been just so greedy enough, because we're already hearing about how these people are decaying so bad, that maybe they just take them purely out of greed, you know?
Right.
It's greed and just power, like, oh, it'll work, you know? And so they're still alive for a while.
Interesting.
Then again, you know, if they're not going to die with those rings, there might be like a wrinkle in this story. Because if they're not going to die with those rings, why didn't the king find out about it and be like, oh, dude, I want a ring.
Right. Maybe because it wasn't like they were just out there for the taking. Sauron was very deliberate about who he went after.
Yeah, but if that king is staying alive for hundreds of years, you know, much longer.
True.
That's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, at some point, three of the Numenoreans get the rings, and yeah, that's
all of us.
There might be one way to get around this, but we would have to address it when we finish the third part of it. So okay. Maybe if we remember, we'll try to do that, but I kind of doubt it. Sorry when we don't.
So point being, the big thing is that the tides have turned. Sauron is now comfortable and willing to go head to head against the Numenoreans.
Yeah. All right. In those days, the shadow grew deeper upon Numenor, and the lives of the kings of the House of Elros waned because of their rebellion. But they hardened their hearts the more against the Valar. And the 19th king took the scepter of his fathers, and he ascended the throne in the name of Adunakor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Adunakor, Lord of the West, forsaking the elven tongues and forbidding their use in his hearing. All right. So their lifespans are decreasing. They used to be hundreds of years long because they when they first got to Numenor, the Valar said, all right, we can't take away death from you, but we can triple your lifespans. So they would live to be theoretically maybe 300 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But now that's decreasing as they decay as a people in general because of their evil or prideful thoughts, I guess you would say. And now this king decides to call himself the Lord of the West. How dumb can you get? Because obviously that's a title reserved for the Valar. I mean, that's not what you should be doing. You know, like Manwë's the Lord of the West, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not this guy. So it's like, again, pride. You know, who does this guy think he is?
Yeah, and it's also like that get into like more signature bad colonial empire behavior when they're censoring languages and then like declaring their own titles in a totally illegitimate way. Yeah.
All right. So now this openly pissed off the elf friends too, because they said, you know, the faithful, they said, Lord of the West is a title reserved for the Valar. What the hell are you thinking? I mean, you're our king and everything, but no, that's too far, right? And so it keeps getting worse, because three kings later, what's this king's name?
Ar-Gimelzor.
Ar-Gimelzor. He got even worse. He not only forbades hearing the elven tongue, he forbades using the elven tongues at all, and he'll punish any who welcome any elves to Numenor. So elves aren't even welcome on this island anymore. And since the most faithful lived on the west part of the island, so close to Valinor, he made them all pick up shop and move to the east side of the island where they could be better watched. Okay. So then the faithful elf friends could now only go to Middle Earth, and there was the only place where they could basically still hang out with elves. Like, they would go to Gil-galad in the Grey Havens, basically, and they would see him there. I also thought, too, this must be weird for Gil-galad and Elrond, because every 50 years-ish, maybe it's 100 years because of the lifespans, you just have to meet a new man, but it's like the descendant.
Right,
so you
right.
get to see what's kind of the same, but then also different. That would be pretty cool. You
yeah,
know?
It'd be.
Besides, it would also be annoying that they would have to fill them in on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't know. That's the fun of Lord of the Rings, is that you can play with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now this is where it starts to get confusing, and I tried to just streamline this as much as possible, not give names where we don't need them.
Uh-huh.
So there's these other people. One of the, they're kind of like, yeah, they are lords. The lords of the Anduni.
Uh-huh.
So the Anduni is the western harbor of the island.
Okay.
So the harbor close on the Valinor side of the island. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And so the lords of this place are descendants of a lesser branch of royalty. So we're on about the 22nd king or something. They uh-huh. were from the line of the fourth king. And then probably just the younger siblings, so eventually they become not royalty. I don't know. They're still technically
can I,
royalty.
Can I stop you with a question? Actually, who are the who are the Elendilini then?
That's Elfriends. Yeah.
Okay. Elendilini. Okay. Same as Elfriends.
Yeah. And so then, so now the Anduni, these lords, they were secretly Elfriends, but they were also top counselors to the king. And so they, what does it say? From the beginning, they bore special love to the Eldar and reverence for the Valar. And as the shadow grew, they aided the faithful as they could. But for long, they did not declare themselves openly and sought rather to amend the hearts of the lords of the scepter with wise counsels. All right. Their nobility, because they're lords, right? And they're descended from royalty just far back.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're the counselors of the king. And so they were, they're part of the elf friends, but, you know, they tried to keep it secret as long as they could and just try to sway the king from the inside, just try to get him to be reasonable again.
Which even the king is referred to not even as the king there, but the Lord of the Scepter, which I feel like just sounds so doom bad guy.
Is that Egyptian? Scepter Egyptian?
I there's a strong case, I'd say. Also, their names are sounding more Egyptian now.
Interesting.
Like, that first guy's name sounded like Akhenaten to me a little bit. Different, obviously. But anyways.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Tolkien's compared him to Gondor to Egyptians before.
Okay.
I think we've talked about that. We'll probably talk about it again in Return of the King. let's see. So, all right. So, one of these women of the Anduni, so that's of the faithful people, and these are the lordly house of that, gets married to one of the bad kings, so the current bad king, and it seems just purely for political purposes. She definitely didn't like it. We don't really know the king's perspective. He probably didn't care. They have a classic, you know, good son who's like the mom, and the mom's the good one in this relationship, and then they have a classic crappy son who's like the dad. But here, the good son's actually older, so he gets to come in line and become king first before the crappy son, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this good son, he comes to the throne and he takes the name Tar Palantir. So if you read the whole story, you're hearing that all these kings have Tar, 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 Tar at the front of their name. So Tar means king in an elvish language.
Mm.
But then what's happened recently, when that Adunakor guy came,
mm-hmm.
the Ad... Well, actually, not so much the ad. Let's not use him. When that R. Gimelzor guy came, the R, that's men's word for king.
Mm.
Okay, so he's using the mannish language, you know, now.
And even the sounds of the words, like the Elvish is like rounded and more melodic sounding, and then the man's language is like just seems like harsh, sharper and harder. Like it has Z's in it, for instance.
Yeah. Now we'll have to get to this eventually, but what other Lord of the Rings character has the R?
I don't know. Who am I? What am I?
Oh,
missing?
Come on.
It's Clifford, gonna be something so easy.
Yeah, it is.
Aragorn?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
name's like Aragorn.
Well, Aragorn's a king, right?
It's true, yeah. Okay. Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah. Yeah. So it descends, well, we gotta get to that, how it fits together, but yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So it's the same deal with that. Right. All right. So anyways, Tar Palantir, he's the good king. Oh, and we already know Palantir, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so far-seeing television. Remember, we went over that. Obviously, it's like the stone that Saruman had stolen.
Mm-hmm.
They should have gotten these at some point, but I didn't notice the reference when I was reading through it this time. So maybe it didn't happen in this story, and it happened in another story.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, anyways, I might just be getting myself confused. Okay, so he went to the top of the mountain that's in the middle where they had the temple to Eru, and he took care of the white tree. So he's trying to reinstate good traditions again. And he prophesied, saying that when the tree perished, then also would the line of kings come to its end. But his repentance was too late to appease the anger of the Valar with the insolence of his fathers, of which the greater part of his people did not repent. Okay, so that's a pretty gloomy prophecy.
As in, it's basically a too little too late situation. This guy might be good, but he can't turn the momentum of the ship around.
Right.
And the Valar are kind of like, yep, that ship's not turning.
Yeah.
It's going right into that storm.
Oh, the ship's going into the storm? I thought we'd go over a waterfall.
Oh, yeah, okay. Over a waterfall, that works.
Okay. Okay, so then the bad younger brother took leadership of the bad Kingsmen anyways, pretty openly opposed to his brother's will. There wasn't any fighting between them, but you could totally tell they're on completely different sides. Totally different values. They probably don't talk to each other at Christmas dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they don't have Christmas dinner. They probably didn't even intend Christmas dinner together because they didn't have it. Tar Palantir kept hanging out in the west of the island, hoping to see a tall sail or some relief from Valinor, but it just never came, you know? So at this point, must have been pretty interesting living in the island of Numenor. Like, talk about a tense time to be alive. More than half the people, you know, hate the Valar because they can't have immortality. But then there's the minority who are also in power right now trying to restore what they think is good and is good, you know, and conventional. And
I mean, it sounds like
wise.
weird parallels to so many different points in history. Like, it's a strangely universal set of struggles, even though it sounds so politically complex.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know, it's kind of, what do you think of like the writing of the story? Because it's both a big range, what am I trying to say, wide sweeping,
yeah, broad, or has a lot of breadth.
Yeah, it's both broad, but then it just, maybe it's towards the end, I guess it starts to actually get involved with each character a little bit more and more each generation. But I mean, yeah, it's kind of interesting how much flavor he's capturing almost at an individual level too with it. It's kind of interesting.
It feels like, obviously, like so much of the Silmarillion and his writing besides Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It feels like an old like epic poem or something.
Right.
It's like each paragraph is like one thought, and then like, you know, every important character has like a string of descriptions after his name. Before leading into a sentence, and so the end of the, like, the language is really direct cut.
Yeah, it's streamlined. Yeah,
but then as you're saying, it goes into like very specific detail about certain things, and I'm just like maybe reading this backwards into it, but like it's what you would imagine like an epic poem or something doing, is like where it randomly dwells on like one guy's backstory for a paragraph just to set it up for something else.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so, surprise, surprise, this is actually very surprising. The evil younger brother doesn't end up killing his older brother or anything. The evil younger brother dies young at the ripe old age of 198.
Ooh.
So that's young for these people. Uh-huh. But his son, so the nephew of the good king, is even worse than his dead dad, who was the evil brother. And this nephew's name is Farazan. Okay, so Farazan would sail to Middle Earth a lot and participate in all these wars for dominion there. And by this point, yeah, Numenor, it sounds like the bad empire. It's only a little bit less worse than Sauron and Mordor. You know, the people that, if you had to choose between the two, it's like, oh, great. I guess we got to take Numenor because they're the lesser of the two enemies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, he comes, this Farazan guy, he comes back and he hears that his dad's dead. And then the whole bad Kingsmen side takes him as their faction's leader, basically. And then you want to read this next paragraph?
And it came to pass that Tar-Palantir grew weary of grief and died. He had no son, but a daughter only, whom he named Muriel in the elven tongue. And to her now, by right and the laws of the Numenoreans, came the scepter. But Farazan took her to wife against her will, doing evil in this, and evil also in the laws of Numenor, did not permit the marriage, even in the royal house, of those more nearly akin than cousins, in the second degree. And when they were wedded, he seized the scepter into his own hand, taking the title of Ar-Pharazôn, Tar-Kalyan in the elven tongue, and the name of his queen he changed to Ar-Zimrafel.
Mm. All right, what do we think of that?
So he basically, it's not really a coup, but he pulls a fast one over everyone to take power and does it in a shady, bad way.
I think it's worse than shady.
Yeah. It's just
criminal and borderline incestuous. I guess you would say it's incest. Yeah. It's first cousins. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's bad.
Total usurper to the throne. This is now like, yeah, the pits of Numenor so far.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I mean, we're going to get to know he calls himself Ar-Pharazôn. We're going to get to know Ar-Pharazôn a little bit here. And to me, he seems kind of the combination between Fëanor and Morgoth.
Oh, interesting. But he's
not nearly as fun as either of them. And he just comes off as a bad guy. And it's just, nobody likes you. You just suck. I would say maybe kind of in like a mold of Saruman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Saruman, by the time of Lord of the Rings, anything you see of him in the book is just, he blows too. Mm-hmm. I don't like Saruman at all, right? Even though Saruman's story about how he was good and he becomes bad, that's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not even anything redeeming about Ar-Pharazôn. The guy just sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So as we'll see here.
But one little note to my Egypt reference theory. Farazan sounds totally like Pharaoh, and he starts behaving, I think, I'm thinking particularly that the Pharaoh in the Bible is depicted. Or like, you know, that kind of, obviously, like Egyptians,
like total control.
Yeah, yeah. Like there are so many Pharaohs. It's almost hard to consider like one description for any chunk of the empire. But like what you would imagine a bad Pharaoh behaving like, that's what he's doing now.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, okay. I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's, I like that.
Okay. Should I take this one?
Yeah.
Okay. And sitting upon this is Ar-Pharazôn's carven throne in the city of Armenelos, in the glory of his power, he brooded darkly, thinking of war. For he had learned in Middle-earth of the strength of the realm of Sauron, and of his hatred of Westerness. And now there came to him the masters of ships and captains returning out of the east, and they reported that Sauron was putting forth his might, since Ar-Pharazôn had gone back to Middle-earth, and he was pressing down upon the cities by the coasts. And he had taken now the title of King of Men, and declared his purpose to drive the Numenoreans into the sea and destroy even Numenor, if that might be.
All right, so Sauron's growing in power again, threatening to destroy the Numenorean Empire in Middle-earth. And so then, to continue, great was the anger of Ar-Pharazôn at these tidings. And as he pondered long in secret, his heart was filled with the desire of power unbounded in the sole dominion of his will. And he determined without counsel of the Valar, or the aid of any wisdom but his own, that the title of King of Men he would himself claim, and would compel Sauron to become his vassal and his servant. For in his pride, he deemed that no king should ever rise so mighty as to vie with the heir of Eärendil. Therefore he began in that time to smithy great hoard of weapons, and many ships of war he built and stored them with his arms. And when all was made ready, he himself set sail with his host into the east. So, all right, so this, yeah. So
he's been fully consumed by his own emotions, or his own, his pride and vanity and will for power. But it's really like the culmination of the very first things we opened the story with, right?
Yeah.
It's like the inklings of those ideas have now, right, like, yeah, come to a head in this guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Sauron claims he's the king of men, and you probably know, since Sauron's pretty crafty and wily, you know, mm-hmm, he probably did that to push the Numenorians' buttons.
Right.
And it totally worked. So now Ar-Pharazôn, determined without counsel of Valar or the aid of any wisdom but his own, that the title of King of Men he would himself claim. Mm-hmm. I mean, geez, how dumb can you get? I mean, if it wasn't sad what's happening to these people that were the good guys, the good men in the Silmarillion, this would be funny. You know, like, it's just that. It's so, I mean, because it's pretty telegraphed, everything that's going on, mm-hmm, here, that there's just not even any sort of redemption coming, mm-hmm, is what it seems, you know? So, I mean, like, yeah, it's funny how just dumb these people are being.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, we want to like this race of people since they were the ones that helped out in the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was saying too, we spoke about this before, but we're dividing this Numenor special into three parts. And, you know, you think about a classic story. A classic story has the setup, the conflict, which is usually like some sort of fall or something. You know, they get into trouble, and then the redemption at the end. Oh boy. I don't know if we're going to live up to it in this one. We'll have to see. We are not on track right now, let me say. So, yeah, I don't know. Any ideas what Ar-Pharazôn sounds like here? Tolkien, real world? I don't really have anything too original, but...
Well, let's see. I don't know how if you have something more specific in mind within the world of Middle-earth and the Silmarillion. I mean, he sounds like Saruman a bit, but really any of these characters that goes bad in their thirst for power.
Yeah, I thought just Melkor himself.
Right, yeah. Melkor, Saruman.
Yeah.
And what about, is there something in real life that you...
No, nothing in particular. Okay. I literally even just said 20th century dictators, take your pick.
Right. I mean, curious, like, when Tolkien wrote this and who, like, what sort of... Because some of that stuff is later in the 20th century. Like, I'd be curious to know what his...
Right.
What he was, he would had, have been reacting to immediately.
Yeah, I forget exactly when he wrote this one. Besides that, I know there was drafts of the idea of this in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the other fun part of this is, do you know, I haven't mentioned it yet. Do you know what the legend this is really keying off of? There's a mythological legend that this is totally, he's trying to do that thing again where he just creates a story for something that doesn't have a fully fleshed out legend.
Uh-huh.
Like he's trying to write it.
If
you don't know, I'm not going to tell you until the end of the third part.
Fine. I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure I'll smack my head once you say it, but I can't think of what it would be.
it really will, actually. Okay. But anyways, let's keep going then.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So now, despite that this story has clearly been going downhill for this whole episode, I actually think the writing and the imagery, especially in this section coming up here, it's been pretty cool, and it gets even cooler, even though it's all bad things, you know, where, mm-hmm, they're completely screwing up. But anyways, I want to wrap it up just with this last scene tonight, and then we'll move on to part three next week, I guess, which will just wrap up the story. But do you want to start that?
Sure. And men saw his sails coming up out of the sunset. These are Ar-Pharazôn's sails coming from
Sailing Numenor. Back to Middle Earth. Right. To Middle Earth. Yeah.
So presumably to like the cities that he had left behind that Sauron's now sieging or was. And men saw his sails coming up out of the sunset, dyed as with scarlet and gleaming with red and gold, and fear fell upon the dwellers by the coast, and they fled far away. But the fleet came at last to that place that was called Umbar, where was the mighty haven of the Numenoreans that no hand had wrought. Empty and silent were all the lands about when the king of the sea marched upon Middle-earth. For 7 days he journeyed with banner and trumpet, and he came to a hill, and he went up, and he set there his pavilion and his throne. And he sat down in the midst of the land, and the tents of his hosts were ranged all about him, blue, golden, and white, as a field of tall flowers. Then he sent forth heralds, and he commanded Sauron to come before him and swear fealty.
And Sauron came. Even from his mighty tower of Barad-dûr he came, and made no offer of battle. For he perceived that the power and majesty of the kings of the sea surpassed all rumor of them, so that he could not trust even the greatest of his servants to withstand them. And he saw not his time yet to work his will with the Dunedain. And he was crafty, well skilled, to gain what he would by subtlety when force might not avail. Therefore he humbled himself before Ar-Pharazôn and smoothed his tongue, and men wondered, for all that he said seemed fair and wise. But Ar-Pharazôn was not yet deceived, and it came into his mind that, for the better keeping of Sauron and of his oaths of fealty, he would be brought to Numenor, there to dwell as a hostage for himself and all his servants in Middle-earth. To this, Sauron assented as one constrained, yet in his secret thought he received it gladly, for it chimed indeed with his desire. And Sauron passed over the sea and looked upon the land of Numenor, and on the city of Armenelos, in the days of its glory, and he was astounded, but his heart within was filled the more with envy and hate.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty crazy.
Yep.
I don't know. That's about all I got for tonight.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. All right. That was a fun one. End's coming soon. Hopefully they redeem themselves.
We'll see. Okay. Thanks, y'all.